Coming up on Boston Public Radio, 6 days and counting till the St. Patrick's Day Parade, 8 months and counting till the midterm elections, and 2.5 years and counting till we pick a new president. Our political panel will address them all. Then Marty Walsh honors another campaign pledge, keeping Boston open later. We'll debate the pros and cons with you.
The Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price in a flare-up over a new production of Annie featuring a black Annie, not a redhead. And SAT changes that could help poor kids get into college. Are sports coaches in college, high school, and even Pop Warner turning into bullies? New allegations against a BU girls basketball coach brings the bullying issue to the fore. Then food writer Corby Kummer on the 2014 James Beard nominees, which include lots of Boston chefs and restaurants, and Corby's own tour as a celebrity chef judge. Stay tuned for all that on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
How great was Saturday, by the way?
It was very nice.
You know what I saw? First time ever?
What?
Squirrels come out of hibernation. Do you know? Oh, no, you were wrong about that. I just wanted to...
I heard that.
In any case, that was Charlie Chippio saying he heard Marjorie say that squirrels hibernate on Friday.
But I did... quickly
correct yourself. Yes,
I had no clue. I thought it was true when you said it.
Well, there's Shannon O'Brien about to weigh in.
Because my dog is barking at them all day long. So, of course, they're running through the trees, correct?
They just take really long naps.
They do. Thank you, Shannon.
And by the way, that's what I've been doing all week.
Okay, so at CPAC 2014, Sarah Palin served up her own variation of politics and eggs by way of Dr. Seuss. We'll play that for you in a while. And on the local front, Mayor Walsh is aiming to let city dwellers get served as late as 3:30 a.m. as part of his effort to reboot Boston's nightlife. Joining us to over these and other political headlines are Shannon O'Brien. You heard her. She's the former state treasurer, Democratic gubernatorial nominee. Hey there, Shannon.
Hello.
And Charlie Chippio is of Chippio Strategies. He also worked in the Romney administration. Welcome back to both of you. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you both for being here. Okay, we have to start with my favorite story of the day. The lead of the day, if not the week. This involves, for people, probably most of you don't know about this story, but this involves the Suffolk County Registrar of Probate. She's an elected official, and she's in a little hot water. She's been on extended leave since January for allegedly...
Since she punched out one of her employees.
Exactly. Exactly. So here's this lead on the update. It's written by Sean Murphy and Andrea Estes in the front page of the Boston Globe. Patricia Capitelli often worked only 15 hours a week at her $122,500 a year job as Suffolk County Register of Probate. She spent much of that time taking, quote, numerous smoking breaks, scratching lottery tickets, looking at East Boston real estate on the internet and filling out puzzles according to employees, quoted in this confidential report. Even before the embattled Campitelli was accused of punching an employee in the face, she had, quote, created a fearful atmosphere in the office, retaliating against workers, blah, 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 blah. Now, I guess the question is, you know.
They both worked in state government, you know.
I mean,
she was an elected official and he was a staffer.
You know, people look at this and think, what is going on here? And the question is, we do hope that Ms. Capitelli is unusual, but maybe she isn't because we can't investigate everybody, can we?
I'm going to make 2 points.
Okay.
One, she wasn't watching porn. And two, she wasn't stealing quarters out of a machine, and she set a new bar.
There now, wait a second. Just wait a second. Now, for those who are not political historians,
yes.
There was a former, I happen to know him fairly well. What was he in Somerville? What was Bonomo?
Didn't he have this register's job?
Yeah, I think he did. This particular one he did?
No, I thought it was Deeds.
A former registrar of something was caught on video stealing quarters out of the copying machine. And the reason she wasn't looking at pornography is because it was blocked.
It's probably. Well, now, that's the joke about City Hall, you know, that you used to never be able to get anybody away from their computer because they were all down at City Hall watching porn.
I'm going to tell you, when we first came into the treasurer's office down at the lottery, we actually blocked solitaire. And the funniest thing the executive director said is he'd walk through the building and you hear people going, click, 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 damn. Damn. So, you know.
By the way, for those who don't know, the treasurer, which is what Shannon O'Brien was, is in charge of the lottery. I'm sorry, Charlie. What were you going to say?
I do have one sort of serious take on this, which is it seems to me that we've got a number of state senators, city councilors who go and they run for these register of fill-in-the-blank jobs.
Right.
Because it's a great way to pad your pension late in your career. She's making $122,500.
That's right.
And so my question is, A, why does a job like this pay $122,500? And B, should we maybe think about not having these jobs be elected?
Let me respond to the second one. I don't know what's worth 122 or not, because I don't know what you're supposed to do if you're not scratching lottery tickets. One, I totally agree with you. No one has any idea except her friends who they're voting for. But you know what worries me more? I'll add a third thing to the list that I think is worth discussing. Every time there's a story like this in the Globe or the Herald or a newspaper beyond our borders, I say to myself, great, they captured this alleged abomination and theft of taxpayer dollars. But then I say to myself, well, wait a second. Are there a ton of Campitellis who we just don't catch because there are only so many resources, so much person hours in the media to catch the next one and the next one and the next one? Last McGrory on Wednesday, you were in the belly of the beast for years.
Oh, thanks.
No,
did
I'm serious.
You know what
I
she just said about the solitaire? I think she's already answered your question.
Well, that's – I mean on the periphery, I don't care if people spend a few minutes relaxing. Yeah. But how – is she an outlier?
See, I really think she is. And you know, I know a number of different people who run, you know, the registries of deeds and probate. They're important functioning offices. I mean, I'm a recovering attorney, you know, and didn't do, you know, an awful lot to interface with these kinds of registries. But people do a good job. They're creating an important service for the public. I really do believe she's an outlier. But part of the problem, and this is what I think what happens sometimes in county government, is that it's sort of like there's no one really watching it. You know, in the legislature, you know, they're up in the gallery. They're watching what the legislators do. It's on television. You know,
right.
In local politics, you know, everyone is screaming at selectmen and the town or city manager. There's someone watching. It's that county level of government that I think it's sometimes harder to really have that scrutiny.
One, why do we even have county government? What is the point other than the fact that it's entrenched and it's been there?
Well,
do you have county government
well,
at
if
all?
You, if, you, one of the, if you abolish all of these and take them over by the state, which they did, you know, essentially with the jails not that long ago,
yeah.
Everybody gets on the state pension. I mean, there actually are some significant costs to taking over all of county government. And so, you know, I'm not saying that it shouldn't be done, but there are some costs that
Got
are associated.
It.
It's not just taking it over and then everybody gets a pay raise and everybody becomes, you know.
Also, there's all those cushy jobs working for the courts in the counties, because you can be a clerk of courts making a six-figure salary and have a very six-figure pension and retire very early.
But that's
early.
A really important job if you do it well to make sure the courts
that's
function
really
decently.
That's
I know it, but there's a lot of in my experience, there have been some clerks that get a lot of help from the assistant clerks that are underneath them, and the day is short. And the
well, but that's because
the
way we fund courts is so bizarre that we have some courts that are incredibly understaffed and underfunded, and others that are incredibly overstaffed and overfunded, because we're the only state where the legislature actually goes in and funds each court individually
yeah.
as opposed to just a
and no one's
a
in charge.
Sum.
I mean, in terms of how you manage it, that's also part of the
okay.
problem
right.
theory.
This is truth-telling time. How long were you in state government, Charlie?
Let's see. Two stints, total of about 3 years.
3 years total. How many years were you in state government?
Approximately 14.
Okay, so 14 and three. Starting with you, Charlie. Honestly, because I don't want to trash this woman with no context, how many times did you see a colleague of yours punch out another colleague? I mean, it's a fairly common – isn't that a fairly common occurrence in state government?
I saw Michael Ruane, I think, punch Peter Torkelson because they wanted to name a bridge in his district.
Two former state reps,
oh,
by
wow.
the way. Torkelson
yeah.
went on,
I'm
of course,
sure.
to be a congressman.
Yeah. And again, I may
too
not
late.
Have
– too late.
But I believe
punched
that happened.
Him?
Well, in this
yes.
case, in the Campitelli case, the prologue was that the punch occurred after both had been allegedly
drinking heavily
yes. in a local bar room. I mean, it just is crazy.
Well,
it's crazy. And you know what? You know, there was a story a long time ago.
At the Christmas party. It's classic.
At the
Christmas party.
There was a story a while ago, a terrible, tragic situation in East Boston where the bridge collapsed and caught the bridge closed. It was one of those. What do you call it?
Oh, yeah, last year.
The
yes.
Drawbridge.
The drawbridge
yeah.
closed and the a woman tragically was killed. And the
crushed.
Guy,
it was horrible.
Horrible. It was horrible. But the guy that ran the bridge was immediately suspended without pay. Now, I don't know what has happened in that case since. This woman has been suspended with pay. So, you know, the poor drawbridge person who certainly didn't intend someone to die loses his financial
yeah.
security.
That's a great point.
And this person is still making $122,000, and she's now going into 2 months making $122,000. So there's no justice in the court rooms except in the halls. What's that expression, Shannon O'Brien?
Exactly.
So justice in the halls. Yeah.
Thank
the
you.
Only justice in the halls in the halls of the courts is in the hall or something like that.
Okay, can we stay
right.
local? We're going to move from county government to city government. I think, Charlie Chippio, it's fair to say that the biggest political story of the last 2 to 3 weeks, without a close second in Massachusetts, has been the give and take on the St. Patrick's Day parade and whether or not a group of gay veterans, and the parade organizers say it's only one gay veteran, but a group of gay veterans marching under the Mass Equality flag will be allowed to march. Two interesting developments. One, Marty Walsh, who has not given up yet, he says on this. And two, I think even more significantly, well, I don't know, more significantly, Steve Lynch, a former state senator, state rep, and now a congressperson, I didn't know till today, has marched in every parade since he was four and is now part of the negotiations with Walsh and is saying, I'm not sure I'm going to march this year if it turns out that they don't become inclusive. What's your sense of this story? And it seems to me Walsh is putting a lot on the line on this thing. I mean, this is really the first incredibly high-profile thing this guy's done in his first 2 months and a week in office.
Yeah, well, a couple of observations about that. I think he's doing the right thing. I applaud him for it. It's a difficult situation because, you know, to keep these folks out is morally wrong. They're on the wacko Hurleys of the world are clearly on the wrong side of history trying to do this. There's no doubt about it. On the other hand, it's difficult because you've got this SJC decision. Where
Supreme Court of the United States.
Supreme Court of the United States. We have all these recovering lawyers here, saying, well, it's private. So there's really only so much you can do about it. I guess as someone who's been in Boston for 35 years but didn't grow up here, the thing I step back from it, and the thing I find so amazing about it is that I think the only event I would want to be at less than the South Boston St. Patrick's Day parade is the breakfast, the St. Patrick's Day breakfast.
You can sit home and watch
and
me
I
on
was
the,
say, television
the television MC
coverage
on
is so outstanding. It's compelling.
Thank
but
you.
In the room, but, you totally miss the Browdy effect.
That's right. But, there's a part of me that just steps back and says, why? Why is this such a big deal? But clearly, it's a difficult situation because the parade organizers are wrong, but it's private, and there's only so much you can do about it.
So, by the way, did you ever do the breakfast? When you were treasurer, I assume you had to do jokes, right?
Yes.
How horrible were you?
Once I was actually pretty good.
Were you really?
Yeah, once
Who
I
wrote
was
your stuff?
We did.
You and your staff
Seriously,
did?
Seriously,
one of the things I was most amazed by in state government, and I'm sure you remember this, is it starts after New Year's. The concern over getting good material for the people who have to talk.
Well, when I first became state treasurer, we actually, we sat around and what are you going to say? And then Tony V, who's a well-known
stand-up,
he's wonderful, by the way, one of the smartest guys I know. I mean, he really smart comedian
for those that don't
know.
Yeah,
but he, so we brought him in. And he started telling me to say this and say that, and I would have been thrown off. I mean, I would have been banned if I had said what Tony V wanted me to say. So he basically said, yeah, it's funny enough, and, go on. He didn't really write too much, but because stand-up comics like Steve Sweeney got himself in a little
yes.
I think it was, got himself in a little trouble.
But well, Guy Glotus got himself in
more trouble
when he started telling gay jokes.
I think this is, I think this is going to be a non-issue at some point in time in the future. And I think that both sides probably need to sort of step back and take a breath. I mean, I don't think that in this day and age that you're going to be able to keep, gay people out of this parade. But I think it really comes down to the terms and how are they going to manage something like that. And I do think that they're going to be able to find a compromise.
By Sunday?
They will. Well, I don't know if by Sunday, but,
I think...
Did you ever march in the parade when you were elected official?
I think I did when I was an elected official because I'm from Western Mass and
I
often went out to the one in Holyoke and it would often be
the guy and
that was my hometown.
Where's the gay mayor?
Alex Morse actually invited this group to come out and march, although they weren't sure they wanted to do that. So
I'm sorry.
I think there is something that can be done. It seems to me that the businesses who are now supporting it should step back.
Yep.
There's a lot.
Excuse me. If you read Marjorie Egan's fine column, some of them, and then go to the website, which I meant to mention to you, of the St. Patrick's Day parade. Right. Some of them are stepping back.
Well, they had a whole list of supporters, and I looked at the website this morning. The St. Patrick's Day parade organizers are now reconstructing their supporters because some of their supporters turned out, like the Westin Hotel, not actually to be a supporter.
Based on your column, but I mean, you're a little modest. You were the one who wrote about it.
I called these places, and there are a lot of radio stations, and your TV station actually supports it by covering it or having floats in it. That's one thing, and you know there are other vets groups that have been very silent about this, you know, because the Veterans for Peace aren't allowed to march in this either, and they are a Veterans for Peace, and a lot of them are very.
What's the reasoning?
Say what you think is the reason. You've been excoriated by some South Boston veterans for this.
Right. Well, what they told me previously, the Allied War veterans, was that the Veterans for Peace are protesters for peace, and therefore they're too controversial. They're promoting a cause and
peace.
And that's why they're not allowed. And many of these Veterans for Peace are significantly decorated combat veterans. Not everyone in the Allied War veterans ever left the United States to serve in foreign wars. They didn't serve in foreign wars, at least one of them. And he's one of the biggest complainer about the highly decorated Veterans for Peace marching. So the whole thing is just a bad situation.
Well, it's a particularly bad situation. We discussed this last week because it's got to be put in the context of the fact that even Jan Brewer, who is not exactly an enlightened soul, the governor of Arizona, vetoes this thing. The Washington Post, ABC, put out a poll the other day, which I'm still reeling about. 59% of America supports gay marriage, which I find to be a staggeringly
high figure. Amazing how quickly
that's the most significant part. Yeah. And by the way, 50% of America not only support it, but think it's a constitutional right
to
be married if you choose to marry someone of the same sex. It's amazing.
The Irish people are very supportive now of gay unions and gay marriage. And the Pope.
I was just going to say, the Pope. Yeah. You're a Pope groupie now. I'm kind of impressed.
I never thought I'd see
you're not
somebody.
Alone.
So anyway, let's move on to something else that Marty Walsh has done. He campaigned for mayor, talking about how he was going to reform the BRA and make big changes in the BRA. Well, wham, slam, bang, he has laid off 14 people and all but scuttled this business development division of the BRA. So he has moved really quickly. Are you surprised by this?
I am very pleasantly surprised.
Why?
Because it's interesting. I'm working on this book right now, this biography of Jerry Rappaport. And before before he was a big developer, he was very involved in all these good government organizations way back in the late 40s, early 50s. And one of the big things that he pushed for was this idea that Boston didn't have any sort of planning compared to other cities. And, you know, he pushed for that. And it's fascinating that a half a century later, we're in this situation where we have this BRA that has so much more power than what any other city has in terms of what they can do. The pendulum has swung completely in the other direction. The BRA is powerful to a degree that when you get a mayor that's been there for a long time, like Menino, it is almost unstoppable. I really applaud what Walsh has done there to sort of cut him down to size a little bit.
What do you make over there, Ms. Shannon O'Brien?
I'm not surprised because he campaigned on it. I mean, he talked about abolishing it. And I don't think he's going to abolish it, but he certainly is going to make some changes in terms of how permitting, how development happens in the city. I think it's an important move, and I think he should be applauded.
But letting people off, one of my colleagues this morning said she kind of expected that he might move people to this agency or that people. He's actually fired 14
including
people.
The boss.
Yeah, including the boss. That's heavy-handed.
It's when you've had an administration that's been there for that long. My husband told me not to use this example, so I'm going to ignore him.
Former state rapper husband, by the way. He's been in there around politics
for
a long time.
But when I was running the Girl Scouts, I had to go in. We were running this. We were going to have a Radio Disney show up at Boston Common. If 50 brownies showed up on a Saturday afternoon, I would have asked for a pay raise from my board. And we were turned down for a permit. And my point is, when teeny tiny things like this can get turned down because there are people inside of city government. And this is not Menino. This is someone who's been sitting there for way too long, who doesn't really understand the bigger picture of things. It shows you how pervasive this can be. So I ultimately don't believe that you can just move people around. And I think Marty understood that you not only can't just move people around, you have to make a statement not only to this one office, but to all of City Hall. I'm serious.
That's the most significant. You're right. The message goes well beyond the borders of the BRA.
Well beyond.
You know, but that's the voice of Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer, former Democratic candidate for governor. The other voice is that of Charlie Chipio of Chipio Strategies, former, he's an alum of the Romney administration. Can we go to the state level. Now, again, you served in as an elected official, Shannon O'Brien, and I cannot tell a lie, I've done a flip-flop. Last week, I'm on the radio with Marjorie saying, you know, if they care so much about this upskirting thing, which is an atrocity, they'll just pass a bill in a day, the governor will sign it, end of discussion, one day. And then they do it in one day, and I come into Marjorie and I say, I don't think I like that at all. And the
because you don't know how it's drafted?
No, it isn't the question. You know, on one hand, it's great that they decide this is obviously
no-brainer.
Not the intention to allow this to happen. The SJC unanimously said there's a loophole, essentially, and they fixed it. But the flip side is, should I be concerned, and should we all be concerned? No public hearings. They just redraft the bill. No public anything. Well, let me finish this thought. Okay. I mean, I agree. I'm arguing against myself. And so I'm sort of, I don't know where I am on this.
Okay, so how do I declare you the winner?
I don't know. No, really. I mean, there's no deliberative process, but I guess some would argue there didn't need to be a deliberative process because that was the goal of the original legislation anyway.
Well, 2 points. I think that there had been a bill filed previously that may have had a hearing before, but
years ago. Catherine Clark, actually, when she was a state senator.
What happens is when you're drafting legislation, sometimes you don't think of everything. And I think that that's part of the problem. And I think that this was filed before as, you know, seen as an issue that needed to be remedied. But it didn't appear to be as big a deal. And so it languished. I mean, you know, that happens in the legislature all the time. But here it was just such an egregious loophole that I think they needed to move quickly. And that's why I think they have had that bill filed in the past. This language
had
been reviewed.
You're right.
And so, you know.
So I should go back to my original position.
Yes, you were right.
Okay, fine. I was right the first time.
There's breaking news that Patricia Campitelli allegedly up-kilted one of her employees.
You know, I'm just curious, Jim, about your flip-flop.
Yeah.
Did you think that the upskirting lobby needed an opportunity to be heard at the State House?
Well, that's
that?
The thing about this. There's no other side.
Exactly.
I mean, normally I would agree with you.
Well, I think I agree with you, who normally would agree with me, that there is no other. I mean, I guess there's a civil liberty side. Whatever there is, I don't know what there is, but I guess the point is that Shannon's right. They did the right thing, and in retrospect, I was right when
you
I said it the
sit
first
up there
time.
During a budget debate?
Yeah, that's
and
a very good
to figure
point.
Out what's going on.
Actually, I'll shut up.
Okay, we're talking with Charlie Chipio and Shannon O'Brien. Let's move on to one thing that I know you're very passionate about: charter schools.
Please.
Marty Walsh also ran on when he was running for mayor, saying that he was in favor of raising the cap on charter schools. Many people were suspicious because he's a big union guy, and he constantly differentiated himself from the labor trade unions, which he was involved with versus the government unions. Now it seems the move for the legislature to approve more charter schools is stalled. Sonia Chang-Diaz, who's up in the legislature, she's not in favor of it. Walt seems to be backtracking. Meanwhile, you have almost a quarter of the
kids. She's the chair of the Senate Education Committee.
Yes. Almost a quarter of the kids in Boston are on waiting lists to get into a charter school. So what do you make of this?
Well, first, I have to say, to his credit, Marty Walsh has always been good on charter schools. It's true about that.
He's on the board of one.
Yeah, on Neighborhood House. Yeah. He was one of the founders. You know, this is the thing. If there's one example of one of the things that makes people like me want to go on a shooting spree when we think about state government, it's things like this. You've got these Boston charter schools that are in Massachusetts. You know, the last time I looked, 2012, you have 20 charter schools, many of them inner city schools, that had the best scores of any schools in the state on various MCAS tests. You've got this Stanford outfit that goes around and looks at these schools that generally doesn't like charter schools, saying Boston's charter schools are doing more to close the achievement gap than any public schools in the country. You've got a recent Boston Foundation study that says a year in a Boston charter school is equal to the effect of a year in one of the city's exam schools. You know, and then what? On top of all that, they say this whole thing, well, I don't know, it's drawing resources. We have changed this funding formula so many times. Do people realize that when a kid leaves to go to a charter school, districts now get reimbursed for six years?
Six years.
And we can't get this passed? This just makes me insane.
Well, okay, Shannon O'Brien. Were you a pro-charter school person when you were a legislator?
I'm a pro-charter school person, but I actually believe that charter schools are there not to replace public education, but to supplement and to provide ways to bring these ideas back to public schools. I get torn because while I think that they should be there, they should be an opportunity to find new ways. What we're really not doing well is taking those ideas
and fixing the schools that 90% of the kids are
go
but
to.
Two
that
things
way,
on that.
We've
two
been fixing
on that,
the schools
Shannon.
For 30
two
years.
Two things on that. One,
Shannon, we never fix them.
One,
I know, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Charter schools are public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, and I tell you what, I'm living this right now. I'm in a special education war with the district where I live in. I'm sorry, I'm going to sound like Rand Paul here. These districts are big, ugly monopolies.
Mm-hmm.
You can't change them if they don't want to change.
That's a great point.
Not a great point. I'll tell you why, because I'm totally with Shannon. She articulated it better than I did. Years and years ago, let me just give you a little context
here. Oh, here we go.
When I was a legal services lawyer, and I was also head of the union that represented legal service people around the country, the most celebrated sort of charter legal services office was run by the late, great Gary Bellow at Harvard Law School. Everybody bowed at the altar of Gary Bellow, and it was fabulous. But you know what the problem was? The same thing that Shannon O'Brien mentioned. I said, let him take over an existing legal services office, like where I worked in the South Bronx, and fix it. Let me finish, Marjorie.
You finish quickly because you're driving
me
crazy.
Unless your position is the charter schools are going to totally replace traditional public schools, the lessons have to be transferable.
We are four white middle-class people sitting in a very nice radio studio here in Brighton. 16,800 people, most of whom, the vast majority of whom, are black or Latino, single mothers, desperate people who can't afford to get anybody to help them on the SATs to get to college. Who are we to sit here and say those people should be deprived of a quality education?
Tell that single
which
parent
they
working
are.
Three jobs that
that's
kid
what drives
can't
me
go to
crazy, with
school.
All due respect, about your position and Jim.
But there is a little self-selection. You know, in terms of the excellence that does take place at the charter schools, one, the charter schools deserve some credit. Some of them are doing better than others. Credit in terms of what they can do in terms of kids' achievement. But I'm going to tell you something. What it has as much to do with is the parents who get their kids involved. Those kids have parents that are going to...
I don't think that's true.
Look at what has happened to those numbers over the last three years. Over the last 3 years, charter schools are dramatically more similar in terms of English language learners, in terms of SPED, in terms of everything else.
Who's getting those kids into the schools? You know what I mean? It's the parents who are fighting for their kids, who are focused. They're going to be... those same parents, even in a public
school. So are we going to doom everybody?
No, I tell you something. This is one of the reasons why I have personal experience with a close friend of mine who I saw lived in Manapan, had two kids who were both Metco students, and she was going to go through a brick wall for these kids to make sure that they did better and that they had those opportunities.
One last thing, and then I'll stop this. We have a terrible problem with violence in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons is there's no way for kids to get an education in large part in Boston. So, Shannon, by the time you fix the schools, which we've been fixing now since 1970, 2, 3, 4, 5 more generations of kids will have no opportunity. It seems so...
And I would just also add, you know, that more than half the kids in New Orleans are in charter schools. More than a third of the kids in Washington, D.C. are in charter schools. Where is it written on a tablet that 95% of the kids in a city have to go to the district schools?
And I don't think that they have to. But I think that we need to take this as a bigger picture than just charter schools. It needs to be. And Marjorie, I agree with you. But I don't think that we can leave the rest of these kids behind. And we need to make sure that we're focusing on all the kids and not just a small slice of them that are going to go to the charter
schools. Some kids get a great education. The more kids that can get one, Shannon, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And to say no one can get a better one except a few
kids.
I voted for charter schools.
I supported them. You know what I mean? I did. You
Marjorie,
know, I did
let me ask you a question to calm us down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about approving education, what's the first name that comes up? When you think of highest quality education, what's the first name you associate with it?
I mean, there must be a Jim Browdy answer in here somewhere.
Horace Mann.
No, it's close. Horace Mann would be second. Sarah Palin. Now let's. And the reason I bring that up is for those who weren't paying attention, we're going to go national for our remaining few minutes with Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Chibio. CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, had their convention, which is a huge gathering of conservative activists. Cruz from Texas, Ted Cruz, Harvard law grad, huge star. Rand Paul won the straw vote for the second year in a row. Chris Christie, who wasn't even invited last year, got a standing ovation every time he said the media is the Antichrist, essentially. But the star of the show was the woman who closed the show. Here she is channeling, this is Sarah Palin, channeling Dr. Seuss.
I do not like like these dirty crooks or how they lie and cook the books. I do not like when Congress steals. I do not like their crony deals. I do not like this spying, man. I do not like, oh, yes, we can.
Now, Shannon O'Brien is sighing as we listen to it. What did you think of that little rendition of her variation of Dr. Seuss?
Are you saying she went to charter school? I knew there was a transition.
Okay,
there.
We can forget Sarah Palin. What's the takeaway from this, Shannon O'Brien? It seems to me, my takeaway.
I don't know what topic we're on.
Well, on CPAC.
Oh, all right.
Two things. Right. One, that Chris Christie may be more rehabilitatable, particularly if he's smart enough to keep painting the media as the enemy. Everybody hates the media left and right for the most part. And that's number one. And number two, that Rand Paul, who I think a lot of us a year ago saw as more of a gadfly. You couldn't predict where he was going to go, like he was leading on drones with all the liberal Democrats following. Rand Paul may be a real player down the line here on the Republican side. What was your takeaway from that conference?
I think that he is a player. I mean, more so than his father. I mean, I think Rand Paul, you know, he strikes a chord. And some of the articles that I read were about young people, young Republicans. You know what I mean? There's an energy around him that I think is somewhat akin to what Barack Obama had when he was first running for president, sort of, you know, on the progressive side. So I think that he can be a player. And frankly, I think that you have, you know, a number of different Republicans. Chris Christie, I think he can rehabilitate himself at some point in time. I'm not sure that it's great in the final election, depending on where this investigation goes. But I do think that Rand Paul could actually be a serious candidate.
Well, not only like your reaction, but I also like your reaction to the nonstop stories until there is a standout star on the Republican side that your former boss, Mitt Romney, may decide to make it three attempts to be the most powerful person in the world.
Yeah, I don't see that happening, but I don't, you know, I'm not in the inner circle.
I understand.
So I think he's done with that. I don't think that's going to happen. But I guess, you know, I find myself in this odd situation of actually being glad that Rand Paul is getting all this attention and adulation. I'm no, you know, Rand Paul is not exactly my cup of tea. But if it's down to a choice between the sort of younger, more libertarian Republicans and the just a crazy Sarah Palin, Ted Cruz. I mean, the Republicans are going to do a lot better taking that more libertarian approach than they are with, you know, the last time you and I were here talking about politicians getting up talking about women who can't control their libidos and things like that. So,
Governor Sarah Huckabee, you know, one last thing about this that I want to amend a little bit. I spent a decent amount of time, as did Marjorie, the last couple of presidential primary seasons in New Hampshire. I would argue that the largest flock of young people last round was not – this is anecdotal. It's not was not for Barack Obama, but was for the oldest candidate in the race, Rand Paul's father.
Yeah.
I mean, the young people's – libertarian young people's following of the elder Paul, the congressman, was immense. I mean, and the loyalty factor was just – it was colossal.
But I think that he actually magnifies that by, you know,
I think
factor
you're right.
I mean, one, because his father – seems kind of old, like an old grandfather. This guy seems young, you know, and can appeal to.
And remember, he did the big filibuster on the drones. I think a lot of people that normally would not be on the side of Rand Paul for most.
Yeah, he's
things.
Gotten some support from people you wouldn't expect.
Exactly.
More than, I still can't go to New Hampshire during that primary. I'm still hurting from working for Paul Tsongas in 1992. The wounds are still there.
Well, he won, even though you wouldn't have known from the Today Show the next morning.
Not well handled.
Before you guys go away, 15 seconds each. We're going to talk with our listeners in a couple of minutes about Marty Walsh's proposal to allow bars to stay open until served till 2:30. You can hang out and dance and drink till 3:30. What do you think about that, Shannon O'Brien?
I think it's a good proposal, but I do believe that it has to be in conjunction with public transportation. I think that's kind of dangerous.
Yeah. You, Troy?
No, I would say the same thing. It's you got to make the T work somehow. And I would say that 20 years ago, I would have felt a lot more strongly about staying up until 3:30, but it's not happening now.
Okay, nobody want to have a little more screaming about charter schools before we
go?
No,
but can I tell you how easy it is for me to give up drinking for Lent now at my age? So,
Okay, Shannon O'Brien is the former state treasurer and Democratic gubernatorial nominee. Charlie Chipio runs Chipio Strategies. He also worked in the Romney administration. Thank you so much, you guys, for coming in
today. Thank you. Good to see you both.
Up next, we're going to ask you, as Jim just said, about how you feel about extending Boston's nightlife by an hour. Do you want the bars to be open till 3:30 in the morning? Is it good for business and tourism? Will this make Boston a world-class city or ruin our quaint charm? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Edgar B. Herwick III here from the WGBH Curiosity Desk. Now, we've all heard that sea levels are rising, but scientists say that here in Boston, they're rising 4 times faster than the global average. So what does that mean for us? Join me and some of the region's top scientists right here at WGBH on March 28th for a live panel discussion about climate change here in New England, part of WGBH's Smart Conversations series. Limited tickets are available at wgbh.org/events.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
And DCI Banks, the Yorkshire countryside, sets the stage for chilling murder stories, starring Stephen Tompkinson as the tenacious Chief Inspector Alan Banks. Watch DCI Banks tonight at 9 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Ginn. There used to be a postcard that was really prominent in college campus bookstores. Maybe it still is. I don't know. It was a black postcard, and written on the front were just these words, the truism, Boston nightlife. Now Marty Walsh is aiming to interject some life into the city's nightlife, and one of his goals is to let some night spots on an experimental basis serve alcohol until 2:30, as we just said, and stay open until 3:30. So where are you on this? Would this be good for residents, for the economy, for tourism, or do you think this will render Boston a world-class city instead of a world-class city? Our number is 877-301-8970. You know, the point that was made by Shannon O'Brien as she was leaving is an important one. If it's done, and apparently he wants this done by spring, he appointed a task force. The reason he wants it done by spring is exactly for the reason that Shannon O'Brien mentioned, so that it coincides with this experiment on the T to have late-night tea service so people aren't driving and that sort of thing. So we want to know, what do you think of this? He's honoring a campaign pledge to essentially make nightlife more available, not just for people who live in Boston, but for conventions and tourists and suburbanites, that sort of thing. 877-301-8970. Are you with Mayor Walsh on this one?
We had some great quotes in this Boston Herald story by Chris Cassidy and Orion Johnson. Here's one from Jeffrey Gates, who runs the Aquitaine Group, mm-hmm. Gaslight Brasserie down in the South End, and yeah. Union in the South End. Yeah. My mother always said, nothing good happens after 11 p.m. So that's one perspective. And he's a restaurateur. He's not keen on it. He runs bars. He could make a lot more money. One of Walsh's Dorchester neighbors doesn't like it either. She says, as it is, we already hear the college kids coming home from bars at 1 a.m., loud, obnoxious drunks, keep them open later. What's going to bring the community the same loud, obnoxious drunks into the community at a later hour? Stephen just emailed and said it might be safer to have the bars close early. We'll let the pot dispensaries be open 24/7. So not everybody is on top of this. From where I sit, it seems like it's a great opportunity for Boston. You hear people complaining all the time that you can't get anything to eat after 10 o'clock. And if you're out late, you got to finish up and go home by 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, that we should come into the 21st century here and be more like the rest of the world and stay open later. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. As it is, you have to close at 2 o'clock now, right?
Right. I think the rule is you can serve the one. I'm not 100% sure. And then there's this hour lag. So essentially you finish the drink you have, you dance, you whatever you want. You know, it's interesting. One of the two places that he's talking about having this experiment, assuming the task force agrees, and it's his task force, I assume they will, is the Seaport. And why the Seaport? I think that gives an indication because it's about out-of-towners. I mean, the primary thing here is conventioners want to have fun. and they want to have fun as late as they possibly can. And that kind of thing, it matters. I mean, let's face it, where you end up bringing your 4,000 or 10,000 or 15,000 people is where your members are going to have the best time, both culturally and socially and whatever. I agree. I mean, you have to make sure transportation's available. You have to make sure the police are there and available, because I think with that neighbor of Marty Walsh's who you just quoted, the point she makes about drunken kids all over the neighborhood is an issue. But if the rest of civilized America can do this, then the answer is so can and so should we. 877-301-8970. Before we get to your calls, we're joined on the phone by actually somebody who has for years been talking about sort of opening up the nightlife of Boston. He's the head of a place that a lot of you know, Carmaloop, and he is also the founder of something called the Future Boston Alliance. Greg Selko, thanks so much for calling in.
Thanks for having me once again.
So what do you think of this? You've been advocating for these kinds of things. Does he get a two thumbs up from Selko?
Free. If I had I'd give it a toe.
So why does it matter so much, Greg? Tell people.
Well, first of all, you know, I think one of the things that's important to point out, and I think, you know, we got to look at it as an economic development issue. It shouldn't be an excuse for people to go nuts and to be any more rowdy or any crazier or anything like that. I think that's sort of a red herring. And I sympathize why people might be concerned. But I think in some ways, if you look at how things have been done now, where at 2 o'clock, you have to have everyone out of a bar by 2:20. They literally physically push you onto the street. There's no taxis, no tea, no place to get a coffee, no place to get a cheeseburger. You can't tell me that's a really well thought out way to avoid trouble late at night. So I think that, you know, I think it's important because other cities do it and we can do it as well. And it adds to our appeal.
Greg, Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer, was with us a couple of minutes ago. And her final thought on this was that the critical thing is that it be paired with an extension of public transportation, so that obviously people aren't driving or wandering around the streets. Apparently, that's the goal of Walsh as well. That's a critical ingredient without which this can't work, correct?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the I absolutely agree, and I think, you know, we have the of any major city's public transit subway system, ours closes the earliest in the entire world. So I think we can probably get by with a little bit later times, and I think one of the things is Davey's been really good on this, and Future Boston's been involved.
Secretary of Transportation Rich Davey, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And he's going to be making an announcement on Thursday. I believe I'll be there and some other people about the new program to run the T until, I think, 2:30 or potentially even 3 o'clock on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays.
Well, you got one guy who's very skeptical about this. House Speaker Robert DeLeo said he's open to the idea, but he doesn't buy the idea that it keeps Boston from being a world-class city, and he thinks that he's worried about more, you know, same thing you just mentioned, Greg, more fights, more drunkenness, that kind of thing.
What we should do is have 24-hour casinos, and then everyone could go there. We could all go to the casino. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but, Greg. But you're right.
See, I think that I understand people's feeling about that, but the reality is, look, Paris has much later closing times. Chicago, New York, most major, Seoul, Korea, Tokyo, it's open 24 hours a day. They don't have a lot of problems in Tokyo on the streets. So I think it's really about how individuals handle themselves and how things are policed. I don't think it really has that much to do with closing times.
Hey, Greg, couple of final things from me. I mean, obviously your business, not the Boston Future Alliance, but Carmaloop's all over the country. I don't know if not all over the world. Does this actually, I made the statement a minute ago based on what I read, but I don't have the experience you do. This actually sends out a message beyond Boston's borders, meaning if a group was thinking of coming here or individuals thinking of vacationing here, this alone symbolically sends a welcoming message. Does it, or am I exaggerating that point?
No, I think it does. I think, you know, look, I sat on a panel with the head of the economic development group in the chief economic development officer in New York City. It was a panel that The Economist had, and I was talking about Future Boston. They were talking about what they're doing in New York. And when I said the tea was going to run later, even though everyone in the room was from all over the world, there was a collective, oh, my goodness, that went out through there, because a lot of them probably had gone to college here. So I think Boston has a reputation for being a little stodgy and having great history and having a lot of great elements, but, you know, I don't think it's reflective of really where the city is today, which is a diverse, young, exciting city that has a lot of startups and things like that. And I think, you know, this is one example of, you know, Boston starting to change and starting to evolve. And I think it does send a great message to tourists, to people who might want to, you know, relocate here. And I think with Carmaloop, we've had the issue with our staff where, you know, they come here, they work late at night, and they can't go to a gym because there's no late-night gyms in Boston. They can't go get anything to eat. They can't get a taxi, can't get on the subway, and it's a bit of a shock.
You know, Greg, we just got an email from Ben who said he lived in Boston for 6 years and moved back to New York for exactly those reasons, everything shutting down. If it didn't shut down, he might come back. So I think that, you know, at least if you're in a 20-something, 30-something age group, the 50- and 60-year-olds probably aren't doing that much, 3:30 in the morning drinking, but younger people certainly are. And, you know, I mean, you want those people to stay.
Woody Allen once said, they asked him, you know, what he likes about New York, and they said he likes the fact that, you know, things are open 24 hours. And they said, well, are you going out, you know, late at night? And he said, no, I never go out past 11, but it would be nice. I like to know that if I wanted to, I could get Chinese food.
Exactly.
Can I tell you, I hate to associate myself with Woody Allen these days, but I lived in New York for 15 years. That was exactly my sentiment. Hey, before you go, Greg Selko from a Future Boston Alliance in Carmaloop, you back John Connolly. Are you surprised that Walsh is doing this as quickly as he is?
I would say I'm happy about it, and I think I believed him when he said that this was something that they both kind of agreed on, this issue. But I'm pleasantly surprised that he's taking it on so quickly. And I think that I had the opportunity to meet with our new mayor last Tuesday, and I think as far as I'm concerned, the election's ancient history, and we all want what's best for Boston. And so I'm excited. I think he's doing the right thing. I think there's a lot of other things he's doing that he's sending the right message, and certainly Future Boston's here to be helpful.
Hey, Greg Selko, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for joining us, Greg. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks, guys.
Greg Selko, as Jim says, runs Carmaloot. What's the name of the local group?
Future Boston
Future
Alliance.
Boston. Thank you very much.
Check them out online.
Sorry about that. So let us take your calls on this at 877-301-8970. Marty Walsh has proposed a pilot program of keeping Boston open late. It might start down at the Waterfront District where Legal Seafoods is and the Convention Center is and a lot of new hotels are. Well, they're not so new anymore, I guess. Southport's been there for a while. But anyway, it's a big convention hotel. What do you think about it? Let's start with Jamie from the North Shore. What do you think, Jamie?
Hi, Jamie.
How you doing?
Great.
I am a bartender on the North Shore, have been for a long time. North Shore, our last call is 12:30. When I worked in Salem, some of the Lynn bars would stay open until 1:30. People would race to Lynn for that last drink. I think if you got 12:30 in Gloucester, you got 2:30 in Boston, people are going to race to Boston thinking they can get that drink, especially some of the younger people. I think you're putting these people on the road, I think it's going to be very scary.
So is it that, or is it also you're worried that you're going to lose business, which, and by the way, I'm not disparaging that concern if you have it, because people may even start earlier in other places like Boston if they know they're going to be open hours later than you. Do you worry about that as well?
I'm not really worried about losing the business. I people pretty much stay within their areas, but a lot of younger people, they want to stay out later. They want to keep going. And I've seen it happen a lot. And we used to do it. We used to race to Lynn for the porthole for last call. And it's just a dangerous thing to do for some of the young people.
Yeah.
Hey, Jamie, thanks for the call. And by the way, this task force is being formed. You should try to get yourself on it, or at least submit your point of view to it, since Walsh is appointing it, I think, as we speak. 877-301-8970. We're talking about Marty Walsh's proposal after this task force meets to allow some bars, essentially, to stay, clubs, et cetera, to stay open later on an experimental basis.
Joanne from South Boston. What do you think, Joanne?
I'm not really in favor of the program, and I'll tell you a couple of reasons. One is the South Boston branch of the Boston Police Department monitor that area. And I think when you're going to institute something like this, where your bars are open a lot later, you have to look at infrastructure, which includes the Boston Police, Fire Department, et cetera. I think, having seen what's happened in South Boston, the bars that are open till 2 a.m., there's heavy drinking going on. And the people that leave the bars don't don't have respect for the neighbors coming through the neighborhood. So I think you're going to see a lot more crime. I think it's geared to under 30s, and I'm not sure it will bring business to Boston.
Joanne, thanks for the call. We have to let you go only because it's a horrible connection. So there are two no votes so far on the phone.
You know, I'm thinking about in the summertime when you have the windows open. You live in an area where there's a lot of bars.
Mm-hmm.
I live right off the tee where there's a lot of kids coming home, a lot of college kids live. I'm thinking really circadian rhythm-wise, you know, mm-hmm. sleep-wise, you're in much deeper sleep at 3 or 4 in the morning than you are at 12:30. You know, they're waking me up now at 12:30. I think maybe they wouldn't wake me up so much, you know, at 3 or 4, Jim.
Well, you know, the first two callers, though, raise points. The woman who just called talked about an infrastructure. The police presence for both of these issues, one, people getting in their cars, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, getting in their cars and racing, as that bartender suggested to Boston, to get those that extra hour of drinking. They got to police that.
Yep.
I mean, that is a pun. And it is owed to the neighborhoods wherever. I mean, there's no declaration. He said Seaport or other areas. It could be the task force could come up with some of the recommendation. It is owed to the people who live in and around on the periphery of these areas that there be an adequate police presence or it shouldn't
yeah.
be done. But Marty Walsh is not a dope. I think he knows that crime and drunkenness comes with this, and obviously it's got to be dealt with.
Well, I also think, you know, drunk driving is a terrible, terrible problem. It has been for quite some time, although we are getting better because we're enforcing the drunk driving law. Thanks to our friend Ron Bersani, who pushed some tougher laws for the State House. But I don't think you should always make public policy based on, and it still happily is, the minority who abuse alcohol and abuse driving when they're drinking, as opposed to the majority who are responsible drinkers and responsible drivers. So you don't want to always look at it from the negative perspective.
Well, especially if there's a negative that comes with it. I mean, those who support casinos would argue, don't make a judgment based on the fact that the addiction rate's going to rise, because they would argue the positives far outweigh that and they're going to deal with it. And that's what I guess the supporters of this would argue. What are you here?
Michael from Framingham, what do you think about later hours for bars in Boston?
Well, I think that the past two callers were a little negative, so I think my opinion has to be positive. And I'm someone that works shift work, and I'm a young guy in my 20s, and I know a lot of guys that work the same shift as I. And when we get out on an early night, which might end up being 1:30 or 2 o'clock, there's no place for us to go at all to even get one drink. You know, and for us, it might even feel like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, although it's 2:30 at night.
Yeah.
And we can't get one drink, can't go home to take a shower. It's a pain. This would be a really nice idea.
What do you do to 1:30, Michael?
I pick things up and I put them down, Jim.
What does that mean? I mean, what I didn't mean the name of your workplace. What kind of industry are you in, Michael?
I do manual labor.
Okay. And you're on just the third shift, essentially, the second shift, I guess, yes?
Yeah, third shift. I'll get out at 2:30 in the morning on most nights.
Okay, Michael, thanks for the call. I think that's a pretty powerful argument,
well, it is,
frankly.
You know, a friend of mine's kid works at the one of the theaters downtown.
And I put things up and put them down. Go
and
ahead.
If you get out at 12:30, because the theater gets over, you have to take mm-hmm. care of receipts and all that kind of stuff. You get out at 12:30, you are like in a mad dash to get to the tee before it closes. And he lived in Somerville at the time. It was a real problem. You can't afford to get the taxi home every night. A lot of people can't afford to have cars, so that's a real problem. And, you know, really, the only place you can think of in Boston to go and eat late is
Chinatown. Right?
And there's Nealon Street has that 24-hour...
Diner,
which I think is still there, which was always great when I went there before. But that's
seedy,
about
but fabulous.
Fabulous. So, and I think that what do you ask for? The fake beer, the Chinese
iced tea.
Maybe you can get a little drink in
Long Island
Chinatown.
You know, one last what Greg Selko said before, and again, it's your one doesn't quote Woody Allen these days is exactly. I mean, I wasn't being facetious. Exactly how I felt for the 15 or 16 years I lived in New York. It gives a different feel to the city. That it is open, that it is available. On the rare night, you choose to do something. And in addition to people like the guy who just called from Framingham, who said he works till 1:30 in the morning, doesn't have time to do anything, and it's sort of like 5 in the afternoon to him, it gives a different feel to the city, which I think on balance is a plus, even though a lot of our callers feel otherwise.
Well, remember Emily was in here a few weeks ago, Emily Rooney, that is, Greater Boston, every night at 7 o'clock. She was in here in one of her lists when she was complaining about things and saying how she was walking through the Back Bay at 10 o'clock. And couldn't find a place to eat. I think she ended up maybe at one of the hotels or something. Everything was closed.
You know, when I was and I use the term loosely, when I used to be a lobbyist at the State House, and there would be, Charlie Chipio mentioned that those budget sessions, when there was things were more small D Democratic. I mean, they actually debated a lot of things. The budget sessions went really late in the night. You know where the only place you could go to get anything to eat ever was?
Besides Chinatown?
It's long gone. No, it's long gone.
The place across the street from the Beacon Hill?
No, Buzzy's Roast
Beef.
Oh,
God, Buzzy's Roast Beef.
It's where the Liberty Hotel is. Yes. Is that where it is? Essentially. But that was essentially
it. The old Charles Street
Exactly,
jail.
That's what I meant, yeah. And it has progressed, obviously, a lot, but it's still most of America's major cities have figured out a way to deal with this. It isn't like we're about to strike out in some revolutionary new way, and we don't know what the prospects are. Obviously, this task force can study what other major cities have done and try to emulate the best and avoid the worst. Gert, you're in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi there, Gert.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm relatively new to Boston.
Yeah.
And I would kind of question part of the premise in terms of how we solve this issue in terms of having restaurants and bars open late.
Yeah.
The problem in Boston, I think, ties back to your early conversation about BRA and other groups. Sorry, I've got a lot of breath.
It's okay.
The problem in Boston, from my perspective, is there is no planning department really effectively advocating development and looking at issues. This issue now about bars, well, fine, we're going to add policemen. Who's going to pay for them? Which neighborhood are we going to take them from? We're going to run the key longer. Well, we know that nobody in Massachusetts wants to pay for the key.
Well, except, Gert, the one major component of this, and I can't speak to the police aspect, I assume the task force will make recommendations to the mayor. As Greg Selko told us a couple of minutes ago, I wasn't aware that apparently on Thursday, the Secretary of Transportation, who I think is one of the better public officials in Massachusetts, is going to make an announcement about this. But the tentative starting date for, is it a year-long experiment? I can't remember, Marjorie.
I'm not sure.
Our second effort, there was one about a decade ago, about late night tea, is going to happen almost simultaneously. So my guess is, based on what I've read in the last 24 hours, that Walsh is not going to start this unless there is some public transportation and some good planning. Gert, thanks for the call. One more quick one. Stacey, you're in Weymouth. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Stacey.
Hey, thank you guys for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Thanks for calling.
I totally understand in terms of like people's concerns with safety and whatnot. But as Marjorie said before, I don't think that we should let the bad acts of a few kind of be the governing body of what we do in the city. I think having a robust late night brings Boston back into the fold of a major cosmopolitan city and
yeah.
gets us in line with the rest of the nation. Personally, I find myself even traveling to visit my friends in D.C. and Chicago and Houston that have a happy hour, and we don't even have that in Boston. I think it was abolished because of like one terrible accident.
It was not just one. This is during the Dukakis
Jim is
era.
Opposed to happy hours.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not going to admit to the caller that I am, but go ahead, Stacey.
And I do understand that, terrible things certainly do happen. But like I said, like you can't let the acts of you kind
exactly.
of take away, the great things that
yeah,
we have
right.
to offer here and be a welcoming state for young people.
Hey, Stacey, thank you for putting the icing on this proverbial cake. That's it for today. And when Marty Walsh is here the last Friday of the month, we'll discuss it with him.
Is icing on the cake a good way to
no,
talk
it's
about
not,
liquor?
Actually.
We should have put the something in the beer.
Cherry on the sundae. Oh, you mean not
yeah.
a dessert.
What's in beer?
The foam on the
foam or the hops
on
or
the
something.
Draft.
Is it hops in beer?
No, hops is in the beer.
Oh.
I think.
Okay. Whoops. Okay.
It's close
up
enough,
next, we are joined in just a minute in Studio 3. We're going to be all revved up with the Reverend Irene Monroe. She's a syndicated columnist. And with the Reverend Emmett Price. We're going to weigh in on the Pope, Little Orphan Annie, among other things. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
In Scituate, one beachfront home has been rebuilt 9 times over 35 years.
One does have to question whether we should keep paying insurance again and again for homes that get repeatedly taken out by storms. The incentive structure now is entirely towards rebuilding. There's virtually no incentive to leave.
I'm investigative reporter Rupa Shenoy. How much taxpayers are spending to rebuild coastal homes? This afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
This program is made possible thanks to you.
and Boston Lyric Opera presenting Verdi's Rigoletto, opening March 14th for 5 performances at the City Performing Arts Center Schubert Theater. Tickets and more information at blo.org. And the law firm of Wolf Greenfield. Specializing in intellectual property law, Wolf Greenfield provides clients with solutions on patents, trademarks, licensing, and litigation. WolfGreenfield.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 for All Revved Up is Reverend Irene Monroe. She is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at Bay Windows and the Huffington Post. We're also joined by Reverend Emmett Price. Emmett is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Towards Bridging the Generational Divide. Good to see you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Now,
Irene said when she was coming in, she had some present. Do you want to give us the present?
No, I think we have to do it when we get to the topic
okay,
that it's relevant
to. Okay.
Don't be over-anxious, Marjorie.
I was very excited.
Relax.
I was very excited. Okay, well, let's we'll talk about Little Orphan Annie in a second. But there are these proposed changes, that, well, they're going to happen with the SATs, and it means they're going to rely, the knowledge that will be tested will be more about the knowledge the kids acquired in high school instead of these, you know, these kind of out of nowhere tests and questions. A lot of people of means, as you know, go out and they spend all this money to get test prep and stuff. So I think this is a great idea in terms of measuring kids' actual ability to do well in college. What do you think about this, Irene Monroe?
Well, I'm not sure how much that the change will really be able to measure students' ability in terms of how well they'll do academically in college. You know, it's interesting. It tends to really reflect a certain socioeconomic environment and exposure. And one classic example is one that I had when I was taking the SATs. And I'll always remember the vocabulary section. One of the words was regatta.
Regatta?
And not knowing what a regatta was, I
mean,
thought, and the choices.
You sailed in too many of those?
No. And the choices was a boat race, a card game, a dance. And I don't quite remember what the other selection was. But not knowing what a regatta was, I kind of thought, well, it must be a card game. And that's what I, you know, checked off. It wasn't until I got to Wellesley, and it was the month of October, and everyone is saying, regatta on the Charles, regatta on the Charles. And I'm thinking, I'll be doggone. This is serious, these card games, you know. And I grew up playing Bidwis, and I said, well, this is what the white folks, they play regatta. It wasn't until I got up here that I understood, oh, a regatta is a boat race. You know, and so how likely is a kid coming from Brooklyn, in general, Brooklyn, just Brooklyn in general, and then giving my socioeconomic background, you're giving race, all this, likely to know that?
Well, doesn't that make it a good thing that they're going to base your getting into college more on how you did as Irene Monroe as a high school
kid? But whose normative are we using? Whose cultural normative? Because, see, we make the assumption that these tests are objective. So if we're going to have a test, it's always sort of reflecting somebody's culture. Whose culture?
Well, obviously the devil is in the proverbial details. When they say they're not going to have these words that no one has ever used, eliminated. See, I know you probably don't ask people in your classes, Emma Price, so what were your SAT scores before you start? But Marjorie conflated really two issues. I mean, one is the issue of a discrimination of the test against particularly lower income people because of some of the things she mentioned. The second thing is one of the reasons why a lot of schools, like the whole University of California system, from what I understand, are not even using the SATs anymore, is they're not predictive, they argue, at all of how someone's going to do in college. Even if it's anecdotal, what's your sense of the predictive value of the SATs even before these changes?
Yeah, I mean, they're not predictive at all. I mean, I can suggest to you that I like the fact that they're paying attention to it, but I don't know what problem it serves, right? Because every state has its own competency exam, right? We have the MCAS here, and unfortunately, a lot of our educators here teach to the MCAS in the classroom. So unless the SAT is aligned with that MCAS, or that CCAS, or TCAS from whatever state you are, then you still have this privilege or non-privilege because the national exam, if we can call it that, the SAT, may not be in alignment with what happens in every classroom around the country.
My concern here, but just Ken, staying with you, Emmett, for 1 second. I don't like these standardized tests at all, even though it's probably
you
the only.
You did very well on it.
How do you know that?
Because you told me.
I did. Well,
you went around when you, and you
okay,
said,
fine,
I mean,
I'll
do
tell
you,
you
know my SAT
I know I did not do that.
Yes, you did.
What, I bumped it in Whole Foods and told you? This is humiliating.
And I said, Jim, what was it? And he said, I got a perfect score.
No, it doesn't. Okay, fine.
How would I know this information?
This is humiliating.
Jim, if you didn't
I'm talking
tell
Emmett
me.
Price, not you, Irene Monroe.
Told us all okay. many times.
Emmett, my sense, I can't stand standardized tests, even though I don't know if you know I did very well in them. I don't know if you heard that on the street.
I just heard you.
Okay, but my concern, here's my view is, the thing they got rid of here, the essay, it's now voluntary, is probably much more predictive of how a kid's going to do than how he or she does on a standardized test. I've had this fight with Marjorie about MCAS for 20 years or 15 years. My sense is the best thing, and there is a question at the end of this, would be something like that, or even look at a kid's portfolio. The problem is, you go to a school, you teach at a school that's one of the largest in this country. As a practical matter, they can't do admissions in the way you and I would probably like them to do, because they'd need to hire another 1,000 people to do it. So what if it's not the SAT? What is it that doesn't discriminate against poor kids and that is predictive?
Or kids with learning disabilities.
Whatever, exactly, you're
let's
right.
Let's include that.
You're right.
I mean, it's one of the challenges is the SAT, the median or mean SAT score is a bragging right for the elite universities. Right?
It is
so,
indeed.
I mean, that's one of the issues. I agree that as a professor, I'm more interested in whether the student can write or not, right?
Because,
and articulate and communicate effectively, you know, via verbal or written, you know, communication skills, as opposed to regurgitating the things that have been taught to them by some coach or by some, you know, elite person.
So how do you do that in a practical way, though, considering the volume of kids who are applying to every school? What do you do?
I think you have to recalibrate your admissions algorithm, right? And I think we have to go towards more interviews. I think we have to go towards more,
so glad you
know,
you said that.
People contact, people touch points, you know, individuals actually reading the applications for longer than 5.5 minutes. I mean, actually read the essays all the way through, not just the first paragraph.
I think you also need evaluations on the students. You know, I think you get a better sort of profile of a student when you have an evaluation. I mean, there are schools that don't grade. There are colleges like Hampshire College that don't grade, and some of your best students come out of Hampshire College.
Yeah, it's a great school.
You know, so they can have a pedagogy that obviously works, and I think that we can employ that. But I think we also got to understand not all schools are equal. We still got to systematically work at bringing these schools up. But I'm interested in, Jim, how did you get a perfect score?
I don't remember that I got a perfect score. Well, maybe I did.
I think part of it had to do with the type of school you went to. I did unusually well for someone coming out of an urban, a background, and that's because of the type of school I went to.
You know what the truth is? First of all, Margaret, I didn't do very well in grades in school. I loved standardized tests. Mm-hmm. I practiced them not to do well. I just love standardized tests. In any case.
You told me that too in Whole Foods.
I did. Let's move on from the Whole Foods discussion.
Scores like that in the history of Philadelphia, Margaret. Since Benjamin Franklin.
Okay. Now, Irene, let's discuss the St. Patrick's Day Regatta. Can we do that for a second?
Yes, we can.
So, actually, most people call it the parade, not the regatta. Have you ever marched in this thing?
No, I can't. And, you know, the interesting thing is that they miss having black Irish, because black Irish to me are those of us who are African-American who have Irish surnames, like our governor.
So they're not only missing
out on black Irish, but also the LGBT community. But I tell you what would stop Wacko.
What would stop Wacko?
Stop Wacko. If you had these corporate sponsors put a plug on it. Just pull him out.
Well, that's
and stuff.
A very
because
good point.
He maintains this old image of Southie as being intolerant. And the truth be told, old Southie is gone.
Yeah.
That image, that iconic image of racist South Boston is really gone. So I just think that at this point, you know, we say money talks. And I think a good example of it was with Jan Brewer. Yeah.
Arizona.
I mean, she said, I'm going to protect religious freedom. Well, we know that the ultimate religion is football in this country.
That's right.
It transcends every denomination. And that is our higher authority.
Well, people that may not know, the NFL threatened that they might not come to Arizona with the Super Bowl if she were to sign this legislation allowing people based on religious freedom not to serve gays and lesbians in restaurants. And American Express.
And Google and a whole bunch of companies. You know, Irene, we've asked a lot of people, are we making too much out of this? And I don't mean that if you just look at the issue in South Boston, it's not important that there be inclusion. There's no question about that. Marty Walsh, when he was here a couple of weeks ago, one of the last questions we asked him was, if the people in South Boston themselves got to vote, what do you think the vote would be? And he said 90-10 for inclusion.
That's right.
So are we, by making this the political issue for day after day after day here, doing a service or a disservice?
They made it political by virtue of their acts of exclusion. Absolutely. They really don't reflect the present day in terms of what Southie is about.
Well, they don't even reflect the entirety of veterans, right?
Right.
Exactly. I mean, and so here's a bigger issue that you have this council, right, who are the keepers of this, 125-plus year, parade. And the fact is, it's about these veterans, and you have some veterans who are not included. And not just the LGBTQ population, but even Veterans for Peace and a whole number of other organizations. So I think at the core is a challenge of the mission and vision of what this parade is about.
And they also don't reflect the vision of our new Pope, who is inclusive of LGBT people. And, because some will argue, well, this is a religious procession down, and I find that quite hard with most of the folks drunk, no offense,
By the way, just don't get angry at Irene Monroe. Kevin Cullen wrote that same piece in the Globe saying that that's essentially what this is about.
But the point is that the Pope that we have is one that certainly would allow LGBT people to march and be seen, not be closeted in the march.
And Ireland has come a long way too, that's right. The Irish people.
But New York isn't any different. I mean, they're battling the same thing.
They are. I mean, de Blasio, the new mayor of New York, is going to an alternative event in Queens.
That's right, because
he wants nothing to do with the St. Patrick's Day.
Just for a second here, and I'm going to temper this analogy I'm making because it's extreme, but I'll get the whole point out. Every couple of years, Marjorie and I and others who do what we do have debate about whether or not when the Westboro Baptist Church comes to town, and they are the most vicious, extreme, sick people. I interviewed the daughter of the leader. I have never met, and I know that's a hyperbolic statement, but true, anybody like this woman in my life. And the whole debate, they came to Cambridge Ringe in Latin, and the debate amongst the high school kids, one of my kids was a senior at the point, should there be a counter demonstration or should they just be ignored? I would say the majority of people in the media say, don't cover them, ignore them. So, and while I surely am not comparing Wacko Hurley to the Westboro Baptist Church, Irene Monroe is moving her head to the side. Maybe I should. I mean, would that be a better solution than nonstop? This is essentially the political issue in this area for weeks now, and it's going to continue through Sunday and Monday.
That's right.
Would it have been better if we just ignored Wacko Hurley's parade? Those who chose to go, and those who choose...
It's sort of like if we just ignore racism, it doesn't exist. But
if it turns out that it was being done, Irene Monroe, I'm surely not defending the behavior. If it was being done with the imprimatur of the state, I would say one thing. Mm-hmm.
It's a million people that show up. The claims are like the
in South Boston.
That can't be right.
I think not.
But I've read that. I couldn't be a million people, but I can't go
for two reasons. African American, and LGBTQ.
Let's take this back. It's hundreds of thousands. There's a lot of people that show up at this thing. You have all sorts of corporations that sponsor it, businesses in Boston that sponsor it, radio stations that sponsor it, and you have coverage of it.
That's right.
On the television stations and in the newspapers. So you can't ignore it. I don't think it's different.
You can't ignore it because transformation comes through contention. And so you have to allow the contention to actually permeate the hearts and minds of individuals who would not be invited into the conversation other than them hearing, your analysis and your captioning of the conversation. So, I think they're different, though. I don't think this is the Westboro, church. But I think when you have a mayor who comes out and makes a stand that the mayor has made, and if you have a congressman like Congressman Lynch, who comes out and says that he's been marching this thing since he was 4 years old, and now all of a sudden he can't. I mean, I think that it becomes an important conversation to allow to get a little spotlight.
But this is what I think. I think that once Wacko's tenure expires, fires, it'll be a different parade. I mean, again, we have this old man, no pun intended, but an old man at the helm that's holding on to an old image of Southeast. As a matter of fact, it's keeping it, you know, hijacked.
Yeah, but see, I would argue, and I'm sure you would both agree, and I'm sure Marjorie would too, it'd be a far sweeter victory if inclusion came during Wacko's time through the power of public opinion.
Oh, I'd agree with that.
As voiced through Lynch and Walsh and others, than if he just moves away or passes away or whatever, and then all of a sudden it's just the passage
of time. I just
want
to say, since I'm so often wrong, I am right that at more than a million people.
That's not possible.
Very
is
different
that
outlets.
True?
All sorts of outlets are saying
a million,
same.
Really?
That's what it says. I'm reading from CBS Local, from the Boston Globe.
So,
and
yeah,
from
we
Slate
ought to
magazine.
Cover it.
Now,
it's a lot of people.
Now,
anyway,
know,
let's move on.
Yeah.
There's a great story about a new Annie is going to be starring, and she is a black Annie. And this has caused quite a fury. Now, tell us what this is about. Who's starring? What's it about? What's the deal?
I'll let you go first.
Go ahead, Emma Price.
I love this story. I love it. Because here you have this young lady. Her last name is Wallace. Quinizane Wallace. I know I butchered her name.
It's okay.
Who is
going to
be Annie. Young African-American, young actress who's been in a couple other things. You have Jamie Foxx, who's going to be playing Will Stacks, who is the kind of the Daddy Oliver, Daddy Warbucks character. And then you have Cameron Diaz, who's going to play Miss Hannigan, you know, that character that was made popular by Carol Burnett in the original 1982 film. And here you have an opportunity for us to imagine the world that I think we want to live in.
Right,
where characters are not necessarily held true to form by their look, by their race, by their ethnicity, but by the dream and the imagination of what this is a love story.
Right,
it's going to be placed in Harlem too.
It's going to be placed in Harlem.
That's right.
Yeah.
But there are two things for me. One, I think that today we have an opportunity and an obligation to rethink these classic stories that reflect a more enlightened time, which is why Jim and Marjorie, I brought you politically correct bedtime stories for modern time here. But also, though,
thank you very kindly for the gift.
You're welcome. But I also want to say this: that this story speaks to me. I once upon a time was the new Annie, that as an orphan of New York State, a ward of New York, you know, of New York City. So it spoke to me. When I was a kid, I always would read religiously the comic strip Little Orphan Annie. Mm-hmm. I'd read that as religiously as I read the Bible, and it gave me hope. And so imagine, you know, and clearly I looked nothing like that little white girl. I was happy to be nappy, you see, and I didn't have, you know, and I have brown skin.
She's a redhead.
And she's a redhead, and she's white as snow. But Little Orphan Annie spoke to me because she gave me hope as an orphan who was going from foster home to foster home.
Can I tell you something? You both make compelling arguments. The part of the story that I don't get is, who is it that is supposedly up in arms over? I mean, the premise of the story, I think, was that we both read this morning, is that a lot of people are upset.
Oh, absolutely.
Because this is what Annie's supposed to be. She's supposed to be that little cream white skin, red haired kid in its traditional setting.
Well,
but
it's the same
who
analogy.
Is it that's upset
it's
about
the same analogy.
What is Wacko Hurley upset about?
Yeah,
I mean, who is upset?
Yeah, he would be. But it's the same argument that Megyn Kelly had during Christmas time when she said, folks, Jesus and
that's
Santa
right.
is white. Yes. And she said, and she corroborated her stance, but she said, well, how do you know that Jesus is white? Because she said the Hollywood classic, the 1947 Hollywood classic, Miracle on 34th Street and the Macy's Day Parade.
This is the new and most popular host on Fox News for those who don't know.
I mean, my favorite movie of all time is The Wiz.
Oh, we were just going to bring up The Wiz with Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, Nipsey Russell, I mean, Lena Horne, Richard Pryor, Mabel King. That's my all-time favorite. And it doesn't say anything bad about Julie Garland, who was phenomenal in The Wizard of Oz, right?
That's right.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because was there a big brouhaha about The Wiz in the 70s?
If you go back to some of the media outlets, there was a brouhaha.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they moved it from Kansas to Detroit.
Wait, is that really true? Because when I said to Marjorie, she said to me, was there a big brouhaha this morning? I said, I don't think so. And I'm guessing the reason there wasn't is because anything Michael Jackson did was okay with anybody. Or Diana Ross.
You gotta remember, though, this is 1978, and this is the end of Motown.
That's right.
And this is Berry Gordy. It's almost like the last hoorah. And you have Quincy Jones, who does the music or whatnot. And it's almost like a Motownization of The Wizard of Oz. And The Wizard of Oz was like an American classic.
Yeah. That's
right. I mean, it's like taking one of the great books, right? Or some of the great, you know, it's like taking Steinbeck. And blackifying Steinbeck. Oh, my God.
There are two things here. I mean, this whole notion that, you know, you can't have black Shakespearean, you know, actors. That's always been a piece of...
Except for Othello.
I was going to say that we do have that affirmative action spot you call Othello. But again, there are folks who really feel that you are changing the narrative. And so I had to think about this. Would I be upset if Porgy and Bess... which is a black classic, had white folks or had Latino folks and my point was is that if they told it within their cultural context, I'd have no problem. Now, if they're going to appropriate it and say give this a black context devoid of the people who are playing the role that are different, I would be very, very upset.
What I wondered about The Wiz? Because I was reading up on The Wiz this morning. It didn't do that well as a movie. It did very well as a Broadway play.
Yes.
So I wondered if it was that, okay, in sophisticated, much more mixed New York, even in the 70s, it was less of a big deal, or theater goers, because that's a higher end thing. And, you know, The Wiz, forget it, in Kansas.
You can just be more experimental on theater.
Yeah,
theater
I just wondered what the analysis was. Was it nationwide, forget it, but in New York, okay? Was that it?
I mean, you have to look at 1978, too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you come out of Vietnam and you have all that stuff. And I'm not sure how any of the movies were doing around that time. And then you have this realization that the music was so powerful in that movie.
Yeah.
And then with the technology that we had in terms of, you know, stuff, it's better live, right? And then there is this kind of quiet sense of people wanting to hear the reviews of what happened. And if nobody reviewed it, then nobody really went to kind of catch up on it.
No, but wait a second. They were not reviewing something with Michael Jackson and Diana Ross in it?
It didn't get great reviews.
No.
It didn't get great reviews. It wasn't...
It would go immediately to DVD today.
The play did. Yeah.
So that was the question I wasn't sure about.
Who was in the play? He wasn't in the... Obviously, he was not on Broadway. Who
was it? I'll give you a recent one that didn't do very well. Steel Magnolias, that had Dolly Parton and Sally Field. You know,
Olympia Dukakis.
Right. And so the black version of it had Queen Latifah, Alfred Woodard, Felicia Rashad, and it went as quickly as it came.
Yeah. Did you see it? Was it any good?
Oh, it was excellent. Again, you know, it's very similar. It's that, you know,
white people go to see a black movie.
Right. And it has an iconic image of it. I mean, if you have an iconic image of it, this is what I think Megyn Kelly was trying to say, the iconic image of Santa is white. So if you and the commercial image of Santa is white. So if you put something else out, a certain group of people will certainly argue about this.
Before we leave, are there crossover films because 12 Years a Slave did not do great.
Unfortunately, Django Unchained did.
No, Django Unchained.
Okay, and part of that, it fits into certain stereotypes. It's demeaning. It demeans the history of black resistance during slavery, unfortunately. It was popular, and popular among young folks. In particular.
Yeah. When I heard the guy got killed by a pack of dogs, that was it for me. I'm not going to pay $10 to watch that.
Lucky you didn't watch True Detective last
night. I know. I heard that was
By the way, Irene, too. Before you go, Reverend Monroe, did I tell you about my SAT? Oh, I did.
Yes, you did.
No, I just wanted to make sure. I don't know if I ever told you.
Did I corroborate that I, too, did well?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I think I did.
Okay. I have nothing to say.
All right. I'll leave that little fist over there.
Okay. We will finish this discourse over at Whole Foods, okay?
I'll see you there later tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you both for coming in. Reverend Irene Monroe, she's a syndicated columnist. You can find her at Bay Windows in the Huffington Post. The Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. What is this music? Do we know what this music is? Okay. Hard Life.
That's from the soundtrack.
It's from the soundtrack?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
They hip-hopized it.
Yeah, okay.
I can't wait.
Okay. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture. That's why he knew what that song was. Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thanks again for coming up. Up next, disorder on the court, BU's basketball coach Kelly Greenberg is facing bullying allegations. When do coaches cross the disciplinary line? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Edgar B. Herwick III here from the WGBH Curiosity Desk. Now, we've all heard that sea levels are rising, but scientists say that here in Boston, they're rising 4 times faster than the global average. So what does that mean for us? Join me and some of the region's top scientists right here at WGBH on March 28th for a live panel discussion about climate change here in New England, part of WGBH's Smart Conversations series. Limited tickets are available at wgbh.org/events.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Brown University's pre-college summer programs, where students can prepare for college success, experience college life, and make new friends from around the world. More than 300 courses available. brown.edu/summer. And Pop Money, available at Citizens Bank, a service where users can send, request, and receive money with an email address or smartphone. Information at popmoney.com or citizensbank.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. BU women's basketball coach Kelly Greenberg is facing bullying allegations. You probably read about it in the Boston Globe. This isn't the first time some of her players, have filed complaints against Coach Greenberg. Coaching and bullying is not new to this sport or to the college campus. We'll talk about some of the examples in a few minutes. So at what point does the disciplinary aspect that comes with coaching cross the line? And how common is this? Joining us for his take on when and why coaching can morph into bullying is Dan Leibowitz. Dan is the Executive Director of Sport and Society at Northeastern University. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dan, we're certainly hearing a lot more about these bullying allegations now involving BU and other places. Are things worse, or is it just more reporting of it?
I think, when you start thinking about the field house and often – it should be viewed in many respects through the same developmental lens as the classroom in terms of, what's the logic model outcome look like for athletes and how do you create a holistic approach to athletics and the athlete? So to me, this isn't a conversation about BU, nor is it really just specifically an indictment of Kelly Greenberg, as a lot of those facts haven't really come out yet. Rather, I think it's a conversation about that we all should be having around what does leadership look like, what does team culture look like, what does workplace culture look like, and beyond.
But let's stay in the sports sphere just for a second, Dan, if we can. And by the way, as the Globe has made clear, there were similar charges leveled against Greenberg in 2008 by some of her players, and the BU at the time basically said, well, she's learned a lesson and she's going to be improved, that sort of thing. We've all seen the video of the Rutgers coach who was throwing basketballs at his players. Ultimately, he got fired. And the most egregious example for me by far, and I know it's hard to pick one out, was that Pop Warner game about a year or so ago with Tantasqua and Southbridge, where both coaches allowed a game to go on well beyond what the mercy rule would have required. It was 52-0, and at least 5, if not 6, of the 10 and 11-year-old football players ended up getting concussions. And the coach of the winning team did these bravado kinds of things about essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, how they have to man up. And so my sense when I was talking to Marjorie about this morning is I'm not suggesting this is a majority of people who are leading men and women in sports, but it's no longer just the outliers. It is becoming more common, don't you think?
I think that there's a ubiquitous spotlight on sport, and sport is just so large. You know, if you think about the two things that really drive our country, although people don't want to say that they do, we live in a celebrity culture, and celebrity culture and a sport culture, and a lot of the lessons or a lot of the movement in social fabric actually happen through sport. And so, you know, I'm not sure. It's much like when we do training around gender violence prevention or sexual assault prevention, and then reports go up. Do the reports go up because people are more empowered and have greater skill set and mindset around what is and what isn't acceptable? And I would argue that that's probably more what's happening here.
You know, by the way, just for background, I should have said, one of these young women of the four women in this most recent episode of BU, if you haven't read the Globe story, said she considered suicide. Another one sought mental health care. A couple of them, and this to me was the final sign, these were not just whiners. Two of them gave up $60,000 a year scholarships that they'd gotten because they were student athletes at BU, which is really a huge kind of decision.
But Dan, you know, the thing about whether it's more common now, though, I've told this story to Jim many times. In the 70s, there was a high school basketball coach in my town who was legendary for getting teams up to the Boston Garden every year. Skip Karam, legendary guy.
Durfee High School, right?
And he used to kick the cheerleaders' megaphones when he got frustrated, you know, into the air in the middle of the games. And nobody and was very tough on the players. And no one thought anything of it. Maybe we should have, but we didn't. I mean, people loved him. He had a great winning record, but he was a really tough guy, like the people that we're hearing about getting in trouble. So my sense is we don't put up with this kind of stuff like we used to.
Yeah, I think that that's probably correct. I mean, you hear the phrase tossed around a lot now. I mean, you know, old school. And yet, you know, I really think that what happens here is that social norms evolve and that bullying is not really just limited anymore. Even the concept, when you say the phrase bullying, you know, it used to be you thought of either the hallways of an elementary school or you thought of recess. But now you start thinking about it as a workplace issue, as a sports issue, as a social justice issue that requires sort of a thoughtful and intentional educational and programmatic response. I mean, it is woven now, the concept of it. I mean, you know, bullying is in an NFL locker room, and it's been a headline piece for a long period of time. And back to your point, you know, what more hyper-masculine sort of man-up culture is there than the NFL? And so I think that what you're seeing here is the evolution of social norms, and then you're seeing a response to it, given what people know about that framework and how they're educated in it.
And you know what I wonder, Dan, because you know a lot more obviously about this than I do, when you look at great coaches down through the years, whether it's in the NFL or basketball or college or even high school, are the great coaches the bullies or are the great coaches the inspirers?
Well, I think it's probably a mix of, you know, it's never a one-size-fits-all. And like I say, history really changes and social norms change and history evolves. And so, you know, if you look at this year's Super Bowl and Pete Carroll, who we had here and people thought was too soft or, you know, was too much of a fraternizer with his players, well, he's someone that's actually looked at a model possibly, and he understood that there's a power dynamic in all work-team relationships. And yet, given that, you know, he still tried to convey not only messages of leadership, more so around collective community, a common goal, and the organizational culture of empowerment. So when you think about him, he's a guy that empowers his players and thinks his players are moving the engine, even though he's a great, you know, mind in the football game and has proven that both on the collegiate and pro level. So I think you see a conversation moving forward.
Well, there were people like Bobby Knight, obviously, who was one of the most famous coaches
of all time, right?
In basketball. That plays like Woody Hayes, obviously years ago at Ohio State in football. You know, can we get back to – I want to get back to this Greenberg thing, if I can, Marjorie, just for a minute. The thing that – and again, this may be a generalization that you will reject, and feel free, Dan – my sense is that most schools, and let's stay in the school level, not in the pro level, are willing to turn a blind eye to a lot of this stuff if you're winning. In 2008, when these first charges were leveled against Greenberg, she was doing extraordinarily well. And as I said a minute ago, the parents of the complaining players said, the school said, we've helped Coach Greenberg appreciate that her style has been difficult and that she has also made substantive mistakes that she deeply regrets. In other words, we're not going to do anything about this. And then lo and behold, when she's not doing so well, isn't this an opportunity for the school to make, assuming that the charges bear out? And I would say, you know, once may be an aberration, twice becomes a trend. Isn't this an opportunity for them to send a message to other schools like was done at Rutgers? We don't tolerate these kinds of things?
I think that, you know, your point is really well taken that, you know, and I think that that isn't just limited to sports. I think that you see that in business, you see it in politics, you see it in a variety of things where when you're riding success, people tend to pay a lot of attention to the success at the subversion of all else. I think here, you know, we have two sort of congruent lines. That first congruent line about sort of cultural change and the norms of that culture changing. Extremely conversant populace around bullying. It's been in the paper every day, like I said, on the pro level and the college level and the level that you talked about. There's a new TV series out called Friday Night Tights that we're looking to develop curriculum around about what does positive coaching look like. And so, you know, this conversation is everywhere. It's somewhat ubiquitous, and I do think that, you know, there's a lot to be said for when success starts to turn into non-success, things seem to change.
You know, there was another story, too, about a coach at Holy Cross, and he did step aside from his teaching duties, and his coaching duties, rather. And
for 3 months.
Was it only for 3 months?
After which, when he returned, by the way, after facing these so-called bullying charges, he comes to a game after 3 months, and you know what he gets? A standing ovation.
Thank you. But previous to this, when he stepped aside, one of these players talked about how he hit her in the back on more than one occasion, and it left a red handprint on her skin. And this woman was a big star from high school in New Jersey, and she talked about how he shook her by the shoulders and yanked her by the shirt collar and squeezed the back of her neck in several occasions.
Is Bill Gibbons, is this guy's name.
Yeah, I mean, that just seemed like way beyond anything acceptable. And as Jim just said, he got a standing ovation.
Well, you know, that there was a lot of conversation around that, and people, you know, in every situation, the facts are probably going to fall somewhere in between, right? You have people on one side of an equation that see it one way, and there's always a very big difference between either intent and interpretation or two people's interpretation. You know, so I don't want the conversation to be specifically about an indictment either of Kelly Greenberg or any kind of coaching culture at BU. I mean, this could happen on any college campus, or allegations could happen on any college campus. It should more be a conversation really around, are we looking at the coaching community? Are we looking at coaching norms? Are we thinking about models that can include both the goal of winning and the concept of competition, but also that need to be mindful and intentional about positive relationships, behavior, and what positive youth development looks like?
And by the way, I think you said it beautifully, Dan, but I guess my answer to your question would be that while you are at your place and doing it, I think, as well as, if not better, anybody in the country, most schools are not. Particularly at public universities, who's the highest paid person at virtually every public university in America? I assume I'm right about this. It's either the basketball or the football coach, isn't it?
In many respects, particularly at major institutions, you know, state institutions that compete in the highest levels of Division I football and basketball, you do see that. And so, you know, you do see a lot of times where you know, egregious cultural problems come elevated in the media and just elevate our conversation, whether that would be Penn State or certain things that have happened at a variety of other institutions. You know, having said that, it still seems to me that, you know, what we really want to talk about here, what are the core values that are inherent in the model that you're embracing around youth development? And then how do you, because when we're in a classroom, or if this was a conversation about a classroom, we would be talking immediately about the effect on students or changing that model of how we teach and what we expect from our teachers. I think that really this conversation should be about, do we credential coaches? Are we credentialing coaches? Do we have any kind of a credentialing type situation that really is educationally based, that talks about these issues around leadership and empowerment, that also has the essentials of youth development in it? And then why is it that we expect so much of teachers but don't really vet coaches in the same way or expect the standard in the same way? And this, again, it's not a BU conversation. It's not a Northeastern conversation. It's a worldwide conversation.
Amen. Thank you, Dan.
Dan Leibovitz, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it much.
Thank you very much. And I'm also pleased that you had Emmett Price.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. It's like a Northeastern-a-thon today.
One of my favorite people on the planet.
He's great. Dan Bye-bye. Leibovitz, Emmett Price, both Northeastern guys. Dan Leibovitz is the Executive Director of Sport and Society at Northeastern. Again, thanks for joining us. Up next, food writer Corby Kummer joins us to talk about food labels, James Beard Award nominations, and a behind-the-scenes look at those reality food TV competition food shows. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Take the money and decorate it with political messages.
So we're stamping messages on paper currency.
to get this message about getting money out of politics out there.
The Ben and Jerry of ice cream fame want people to deliver messages on cash to start a movement to repeal Citizens United. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Samets Blackstone Associates for more than 30 years helping businesses and nonprofits tell their stories and build relationships through integrated brand strategy, design, and digital media. On the web at sametz.com.
An orchestra of Indian Hill, Maestro Bruce Hangin conducts Prokofiev's Suite from Romeo and Juliet and Elgar's Cello Concerto on Sunday, March 16th at 3 p.m. in Littleton. More at indianhillmusic.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about food, from star chefs to reading between the new FDA label lines, is Corby Kummer. Corby, as you know, is a senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning food writer. Hey, Corby.
Hey there.
You know, just when you walk in the room, I get hunger pangs. I don't know what that's about, Corby Kummer.
Pavlov.
Yeah, I guess. But we had Art Kaplan, who a medical ethicist in here, and he was talking about, he was kind of poo-pooing the idea that this food labeling that's been proposed, we know a lot more about foods labeled in stores, foods at restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't think it was going to be make a big deal in people's choices for foods. Jim thought it was going to be huge. So what do you think?
No, but specifically the label on packages at stores, you know, larger calories, how much sugar is added, make the portions somewhat related to the real world. What do you think about that?
First of all, remember, it's a good 2 years off before it's implemented. There's going to be a long comment period, and that's going to be very controversial. And just announcing something is a huge step because it's the beginning of a long conversation that's usually a huge food fight. To coin a phrase.
Ba-dum-bum. Thank you.
I think it's huge.
A good thing.
Yeah, I think it's huge as in good.
So do I.
And what's really good is finally getting real about portion sizes. So it's, you know, nobody has a half cup of ice cream. Come on. You
which
know,
is the current portion size on ice cream, which is ridiculous.
It's crazy. So you think, oh, good, 200 calories. It's nothing. You know, it's just twice my low-fat yogurt, which I hate. I'll just have some ice cream. But in fact, you're through 450 calories worth of ice cream before you understand it. Same thing with a bottle of soda or iced tea or fruit juice. The idea that there's in a small bottle that there's two servings. Of course it's not two servings. It's one serving. So that's been an enormous defect of these rules. And posting in much bigger letters the calories in the entire package, much better. You know, for example, pretzels. I like pretzels.
I do too.
And I get, you know, they're low fat. They're like no fat. They're high in sodium, but you can get the kind of lower sodium ones. But when you look at the actual portion size of a rolled gold or any brand you want to name, you know, I like pretzels. And then when you realize, no, I'm going to go through this box, and that's about 400 to 500 calories. Easy. And I think I'm getting away with 80 calories a serving. Nobody has a serving, you know.
Wait a minute. How many pretzels are in one serving?
Depends entirely on the size of them. If you get the mini, if you get the 1-inch, get the 2-inch, the big ones. But it adds up fast, and that's what these new labels are much better at, saying what it's going to add up to and giving you an idea. I'm really in favor of added sugars. It's what I most wanted to see.
Which will be a separate line for the first time if this plan goes through.
Right. But without an idea of how much added sugars you should or should not be having a day, it doesn't really make sense. It's, you know, the avant-garde. It's the beginning of people's understanding they should not be having beverages or foods with added sugar, meaning the things that aren't already naturally in fruit, all this kind of added evaporated cane juice. There are all these euphemisms for sugar.
Yeah, high fructose corn syrup. That was one I didn't realize.
I usually order extra evaporated cane juice on the side, yeah. Corby. See, let me tell you, I'm glad you agree with us, even though I have great respect for Art Kaplan, who thought, again, it was a big nothing because people don't read them. However, it only does half the job. Marjorie, close your ears because you're going to hate this. Unless we have comparable things on restaurant menus, which I know is going to destroy all the fun for people because you want to go out and have fun and be uninhibited. Unless we have them on restaurant menus, you've only sort of done half the job. So good what you buy in a supermarket, hopefully, in the best case scenario, you'll pay attention. But then when you go, what's the name of that place that has the biggest portions in America? I always mention.
Oh, Cheesecake,
Cheesecake Factory. And your typical portion is 14,000 calories. then you haven't achieved much,
have
you?
Here's the really distressing point about the labeling proposals, which was a really good move of the White House Let's Move. I think it was in honor of its third birthday. So that was great. You know, you say until. In fact, the job's been done. As part of the Affordable Care Act, national menu labeling
chains,
for calories.
Right?
Yeah, chains. But it's fairly small chains. I can't remember if it's 14 or 20. It was endlessly debated how many locations there should be. It's going to be a great thing. Have we seen it? Has it gone into effect? Have they released their regulations? No, it's years behind. So it's enormously frustrating, especially because the Massachusetts state legislature, full disclosure, my spouse was health commissioner at the time and helped push it through, voted for calorie labeling in the state of Massachusetts.
So
at the same time, Philadelphia, Portland, and other cities did. What happened at the time was the feds said, oh, no, wait, we've already passed it. Wait until we do the national regulation so there isn't a conflict between state by state. We want one uniform labeling requirement because these big chains, if they're in multi-states, don't want to have to re-gear twice. So, you know, the state said, okay, fine. They went along with it, even though I'm not sure they actually had to, but they thought this is going to come down the road very soon. Years later.
I can totally see that in restaurants that you might go to a lot, especially with your kids, like a Friendly's or whatever. But if you go out to a high-end restaurant, like some of the ones that are James Beard nominees, like a Oleana,
I mentioned
sense
this
in
very
Cambridge.
Subtle segue, Marjorie.
Yeah. I don't know. If I'm paying an arm and a leg for a special occasion dinner out, do I want to have all the calories?
How about a compromise before Corby responds?
Filet mignon.
When you're going to a really
salmon.
Good restaurant, then the solution, which is where some of the richest sauces will probably end up, by the way, is how about as a compromise, even though it does make me happy, but so you'll be happy. It says at the bottom of the menu, if you'd like a separate sheet,
perfect.
Which has
that's
all the calories
perfect.
On. Now, again, that's one little foot in the
I
door.
Don't
it's not
know
enough.
About the creme brulee.
Settle the
you
difference
know, it
ruins here, Corby.
My whole enjoyment of the creme brulee to know it's going to kill me
Jim,
tomorrow.
The thing is, you are opening the door to the devil. And because
then I take it back.
Exactly that conversation that kept national regulations out of the marketplace for so long, because you're opening the door to voluntary compliance.
You're right. You're
on
right.
The
I
fact
take it
of
back.
Industry. And that's the way it was for years, that McDonald's or Pizza Hut or Starbucks, they all had nutrition information. Just dial it up on the web. Just write away for our friendly pamphlet and wait forever and don't look
Didn't
at it.
Didn't you hear me say I gave up 5 minutes ago?
Okay,
you keep beating me and beating me. I was wrong.
However, Marjorie, you're in luck. It's never going to happen for high-end restaurants.
Why not?
It's too expensive for them and they change their menus too often. It's not worth trying to get them to do it. So
okay.
It's not going
Great.
To happen.
Would you want to go to Oleana and have every calorie counted on your menu, Jim?
I would want to go to Oleana if I were waterboarded before. It's so good.
Go
it wouldn't
to
make
Oleana
any difference
every
to me.
Night of the week.
Okay, well, say, in light of that fact, let's talk about some of these James Beard nominees and highlight some of the regional ones that excite you the most. First of all, what are the James Beard Award for the uninitiated, which, by the way, includes me? What is that a recognition
and
of?
And another disclosure, I'm a longtime member of the James Beard Restaurant Awards Committee, which I really enjoy, and I have incredibly esteemed colleagues from around the country who work extremely hard to make the ballot that you're talking about, which is the semifinalists, lists of 20, a great and representative list of different prices, different ethnicities, different regions. And we're really proud of what we do, and the whole group of voters is great.
And what kind of category? I mean, what are the different categories? You say the semifinalists are 20 per category, or right. whatever it is. What? Give us an example of
so
some of the categories
let's go straight,
some of the local.
Let's go straight to the ones I'm excited about.
Okay.
So for both Best New Restaurant and Rising Star Chef, which are time limited, Best New can obviously only be 1 year. That's the calendar year of the awards. These are the 2013 awards. And we have two local places I really love. Asta on Mass Ave, which I've talked about on the show before.
Oh, we did talk about that with you, yes.
And Ribelle in Brookline.
Yeah,
I
don't know what it is.
Never can really
I've been there, though.
But so Tim Maslow is Rising Star, and Ribelle and Asta are on the Best New Restaurant. Rising Star is under 30. We have to get them to photocopy their driver's licenses. It's
no, is that true, really, to make sure they're not lying?
Yeah, and we've had people try to forge their driver's licenses. It's not easy. It's the nightmare fact check of the year. But Tim Maslow's still under 30, and he's on that list. And we've got these two terrific local restaurants that I was very excited about, both of them last year. So I'm excited to see them on the list of 20.
And what's the, I mean, if something wins an Academy Award, they mentioned, I heard over the weekend that 12 Years a Slave went back into the top 10 this week because it had won Best Motion Picture, and obviously that gets a little bit of a buzz. If you win a James Beard, or even if you're a semifinalist or a finalist, if you win a James Beard Award, is there a significant chunk of the population that will go to a restaurant or which has the up-and-coming chef or best new restaurant or any of the other categories where they might not have gone otherwise? Is there any indication of that, or is it just an intra-industry recognition?
I wonder if I've seen data. No, it is. There's nothing minor about it. It's very big for a restaurateur, which is why we used to keep the list of 20 secret, and we hope nobody ever found out about them. Now we publicize it. There was a whole announcement ceremony in Orlando, Florida. And it's something that chefs always have with them. And if they become one of the top five, I can't remember when, but in March, right around now, we'll come back on and we'll talk about the top list of five. They're the actual nominees, not the semifinalists. They use that nomination the rest of their careers. And if they've won an award, you know, it's like Pulitzer Prize winning. It's like Oscar winning. It's the first clause on the bio.
We should mention Oleana that we've been talking about. That's on the list for Outstanding Chef. And also, this restaurant has been around forever, and it's still making the greatest outstanding restaurant, Hammersley's in South Boston. That's got to be at least 25 years old.
In the South End. Well, yeah. That's probably 25 years. But Oleana passed its 10th anniversary. And the rule for Outstanding Restaurant, the national category, is that it's been in business for 10 years.
Okay. And also a woman that we had in here with her husband, Joanne Chang from Flower Bakery, gets a nomination for Best Chef.
Joanne Chang is such a talent nationally, such a wonderful person and role model for so many young chefs. And what I'm particularly pleased with is that it shows that a pastry chef, though she's also has the terrific Myers & Chang, which is home-style Chinese food and a standby for me. I go there often on my own dime. A pastry chef is eligible in these regional categories as best chef of the Northeast or best chef of the Northwest. And I'm really glad she's risen. She was a nominee last year. We'll see if she's a nominee this year. But it's very exciting to have a pastry chef in these national categories.
So in one of these categories, I mean, just looking at this first thing here, like best, the first one is best new restaurant. You say there are 20. Well, it looks like 20. Asta in Boston. No, I wasn't questioning
no,
you.
No, there can be more in the two time limited ones.
Oh, maybe there are. Okay, whatever there are. 20, 25, whatever. How do you vote? I mean, we know you know Asta. You've written about it. We've spoken about it. All these New York, Chicago, West Hollywood, Brooklyn, on and on. How do you vote? I mean, it isn't like they can send you a movie and you can vote for the best movie in the Academy Awards. How do you decide where the best new restaurant is? They don't ship you to all these places, I hope.
Gee, wouldn't it be nice? No, there's like 17 of us from all over the country. All of us, the rule, and boy, is it a hard rule to follow, all of us have our meals reimbursed. We never take free meals. In the age of Yelp, that is a dying, almost dead breed of people who pay for their own meals or have their businesses pay for their meals so they can be thought to be objective. So we come from all over the country. There are thousands of nominations from a call to entry that is open to absolutely everybody, very widely publicized on the jamesbeard.org website. And so we sift through. Plus, each of us in the regions, the 10 regions, has a panel of 25 judges. And we canvass them. We make them reply to our own surveys. And we ask, you know, I don't know New Hampshire. So Tina Antolini, a wonderful committee member in Western Mass, and I canvass all the 25 Northeast judges and say, who do you think? Who do we go and fight for? And then, boy, do we fight. So everybody fights for their favorites. But it's people who have experienced the restaurant and are experienced critics or judges.
We have less than a minute left, but can you tell us very quickly, Myers & Chang chef, we just mentioned Myers & Chang, she's going to be battling this Bobby Flay in one of these network cooking competitions. You've been a judge.
Yeah, the thing is, I don't know if it's going to be, if it was broadcast as a preview, because I found it, we dialed it up on Comcast, and I saw, I'm in the second episode, and it is a competition of chicken and waffles, and the Myers & Chang chef, a woman, Karen, and Bobby Flay himself duke it out for chicken and waffles. And I got to taste both and sample them. And they very kindly kind of gave me the lead judging vocalees in it. It was a really fun and great experience.
You know, next time you're here, I want to discuss these chef reality shows, which I know are all the rage. I know you've been involved, and we're going to talk to him about it. Corby Kummer, it's great to see you. Thanks so much
for
your time.
So thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we have health economist Jonathan Gruber. He was one of the architects not only of Romney Care, but of so-called Obamacare. He's going to talk to us about health care. Nancy Kane also joins us for Open Mic, which is going to be great. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, John Parker, Will Roselip, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you again for tuning in, and please tune in again tomorrow.